Turning now to the book of Exodus, chapter 20, and I shall read the first three verses of the chapter. And our subject is the riches of God's law. And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And before proceeding, I'd like to read just one or two passages very briefly which set the scene for the giving of the law in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 4 and 5. The Lord talked with you face to face in the mount out of the midst of the fire. Says Moses, I stood between the Lord and you at that time to show you the word of the Lord, for ye were afraid by reason of the fire, and went not up into the mount. And then verses 22 and 23 of Deuteronomy 5, these words the Lord spake unto all your assembly in the mount, out of the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick darkness, with a great voice. And he added no more, and he wrote them in two tables of stone, and delivered them unto me. And it came to pass, when ye heard the voice out of the midst of the darkness, for the mountain did burn with fire, that ye came near unto me, even all the heads of your tribes and your elders. And then maybe back to Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 10. Especially the day that thou stoodst before the Lord thy God in Horeb, when the Lord said unto me, Gather me the people together, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. And ye came near, and stood under the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire unto the midst of heaven, with darkness, clouds, and thick darkness. And the Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. He heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude, only ye heard a voice. And he declared unto you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments. And he wrote them upon 2 tables of stone. Well, we could gather all that information together, and we could build up a picture of the might and majesty, the way in which God appeared and spoke to them in the time of the giving of the law. I'd like also to refer, but I'm not turning there, to Romans chapter 7 and verse 12, where the Apostle Paul says most significant words about the law of God in the Ten Commandments. The law is holy, and the commandment is holy and just and good. Now there is the Apostle Paul in the midst of his teaching that no man is justified by the works of the law. But that doesn't mean that the law is not excellent and holy and just and fair and good. It does not mean that the law is anything less than perfect. The law declares the mind of God about right and wrong. The law reflects the very character of God, tells us about him if we study it in order to see the mind of the author. But the law, of course, cannot make righteous because of the sinfulness of men and women. And so the law is over us as a great warning to us and a threat. Fail to keep the law, and we're everlastingly condemned. We cannot know the blessing and the goodness of God in this life or in the life hereafter. So the law threatens and warns, and yet to the believer who is freed from the law in the sense that the law will no longer condemn him because Christ has died for him. And Christ has borne away the punishment due to him on his behalf. So he no longer is threatened by the law or frightened by the law, but the law now continues to be the rule of righteousness for his life. And he loves it and longs to be able to honour it. And that is the position of the Christian faith. Now, friends, in this church, we have a legal constitution, and it is based on an even older constitution, which is inherent in the trust deed of the 19th century building. And it isn't very long in its expression, but one of the things it says is this, that we as a congregation, as a people, realize that we are under the moral law of God. And that's what all church trust deeds used to say, or the vast majority of them. Christian people have always grasped the teaching of the Word of God, that we are saved by Christ, we're no longer condemned by the law, but we continue to be under it. It is the rule of life for the believer. And it's our longing and desire, by the help of God, to honour it and to understand all its implications. Well, we come back to the very beginning of the giving of the law. God spake all these words, saying, the law, remember, is holy. That means it's awesome in the Hebrew. It's sacred. It's holy. It's a holy thing, the law of God. And when God says, be ye holy, for I am holy, he is telling us that the Ten Commandments, the law, the moral law, reflect his own holy character. He is the author of him. They describe him. They're not laws which God has announced in this world simply for the administration of human society. They are laws that last forever. Now, sometimes that puzzles us. We think, really? There will be perfection in heaven. There will be no need for a law forbidding murder or for a law forbidding adultery. There will be no need for a law which warns us against all forms of idolatry, because these things won't exist in heaven. So surely we may reason the Ten Commandments, the law of God, that's only for the administration of life in this fallen world. Oh no. Because the law reflects the very character and nature of God. As the old confessions used to say, it is founded upon the essential nature of God. When God says, thou shalt not kill, he is telling us about himself. That actually, though God, of course, has the right to take life as he gave it, and he is a God of justice and will punish, God essentially is a giver, not a taker. He's a giver, not a spoiler. He's a preserver, not a destroyer. You see, even that commandment, even though you may say it will be irrelevant in the form we have it in heaven, it still reflects the very being and character of God. The glory of heaven is that God is, among other things, that commandment. It flows out of his heart. Thou shalt not kill. So we know in the everlasting glory, God will keep his own commandment. He must. It's his character. It's his nature. And there'll be no more death, no more sighing, no more sorrowing, no more separation. That's God's commandment. So all the commandments, they reflect the eternal ways of God in some shape or form. And that helps us to understand them as we go through them and to marvel at them. The commandment, says the Apostle Paul in Romans 7, is just. That means it's just and fair, self-evidently so. All the commandments, you cannot find anything unfair in them. They are so just. So good, so fair, they cannot come under criticism. They are good, meaning in this context, they are beneficial. They do good, all of them. Why the commandment not to commit adultery? is, if kept, beneficial, because it keeps people together and families together and harmony and love, and all the commandments are immensely beneficial. The Apostle Paul was speaking under inspiration. He wasn't just bandying about words when he said the commandment is holy, pure, awesome, sacred, perfect. When he said it's just, fair and right, beyond all criticism. When he said that it was good, beneficial, always, deeply so, deeply injurious for people or society to break, bend or twist any one of these glorious commandments. So that's just by way of introduction. Look down then at verse 2 of chapter 20. I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Well, you can see that the children of Israel had a particular obligation and debt to keep the law. God had shown great mercy to them and had delivered them from all their miseries. As we, just before we look at individual commandments too, let me remind you of several things. The commandments, as I've just been saying in a different form, have full authority today. To non-Christians, to Christians. We shall be judged by the Ten Commandments. To Christian people, they are authority for life, our perpetual rule. All of them are reaffirmed in the New Testament. Sometimes that's debated, but given time, we'll look even at that. All of them are affirmed in the New Testament. Yes, they form a great iron gate or drawbridge to the city of God, to those who are unbelievers, and they bar the way. You have not kept these commandments. You cannot have the favour of God. But to believers, well, they're designed for the blessing of those who trust in the Lord and believe in him. Each commandment, I've said this so many times, I hope it's something you appreciate, but each commandment is the head of a family of sins. Now that is how Moses expounds them under inspiration. As you go through the five books of Moses on different passages, he breaks down and elaborates the commandments and explains them. And as he does so, he demonstrates that each commandment is really a representative sin in a family. And then the Lord Jesus Christ says exactly the same. Well, of course he would, because he was the author, really, of everything that Moses said. It is his word. It's the word of Christ. And the Spirit inspired Moses according to the dictating, the word, as it were, of Christ himself. So we're not surprised that Christ says things exactly in accord with the commentary given by Moses. So each commandment is a family of sins. Murder, for example. The Lord Jesus Christ clearly teaches, as does Moses, that murder includes hatred. And not only does it include hatred, it includes a number of other things. Moses says it includes kidnap and slavery. That's in the murder family of sins, to take away somebody's liberty or self-respect. Moses teaches very clearly that a child, a grown child, son, daughter, will be condemned by God if they take away or rip away their parents' self-respect and happiness and peace. Now, parents do wrong things, sometimes to grown children. We're not entering into that. But if children are mean and betray their parents and make them small and reject them and make them feel bad and their life has come to an end, it's in the murder category of sins to tear away a parent's self-respect and happiness and joy and peace. So the commandments are interpreted by Moses and also explained by the Lord, so to show that each named prohibition represents a whole family of sins. And when we look at the commandments, we have to consider that. Adultery, not only the act, but lusting in the heart, is in that family of sins. And a person is an adulterer if the lust only lives in the heart. In the sight of God, we're under condemnation, and the adultery sin has been committed. You may say that many sins in the family are lesser sins, but they're still sins, and they break the law of God. And the commandments deal with the king's sin in each family. And so that we always bear in mind. Of course, we have to remember this. The worldling doesn't understand this kind of thing in the Bible. But we remember this, that if a commandment prohibits a certain deed or act, then the commandment, in effect, also is laying upon us a duty to accomplish the opposite positive virtue. So we not merely abstain from adultery, we promote faithfulness and kindness and unity between husband and wife. The opposite positive virtue is all important. They're not just prohibitions. And so we remember all those things when we look at the commandments. That's why in the nonconformist churches we don't agree with the Anglicans, who will in the liturgy repeat endlessly, many times, the Ten Commandments. Now you may think, oh, surely that's a good thing. Well, yes, if it's done once, maybe. But when it's done over and over and over again, every week, so many services and so on, then it has the effect of emptying the commandments of their fullness, because people become very familiar and just rattling off the commandments. They never look below them. They think of murder, but not hatred, or adultery, but not lust, or flirting, and so on, just for kicks. Dear friends, the endless vain repetition tends to take the depth and the sense and the challenge away. It means they're not taken so seriously. You may say, well, that's not essential. We shouldn't judge everyone. Well, that's right. But that's the tendency. And that's why in the nonconformist churches there has been a recoiling far away from liturgy because of that kind of effect. But that's really another subject. Let's look at verse 3. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Now, I'm not going to do anything exhaustive. This is the first commandment. But just draw attention to the riches of the commandments. We're talking about this just very recently in an evening gospel sermon. No other divine beings before God. And you consider what that means. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, because it will be entirely unnecessary. And I called upon people in the church the other evening to listen. Don't you hear what it says? Don't you hear the words that are there? I will be your God. You may know me. You may address me. You may appeal to me. And I will be your guardian and your keeper and your teacher and your father and your friend. You will need nothing beside me in terms of a God. I will be your perfect God, and I will bless you and help you and strengthen you in every situation, every circumstance in life. Do you not hear those words? Just look carefully. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. I am fully sufficient for you. I will be everything to you. When you think about it, are they not the most tremendous words you could possibly hear? You recite them endlessly, you don't see what lies behind them so often. And the depth and the richness and the value of the promise of God to be your only God and all that you could possibly need. the sole source of truth, the sole source of happiness and comfort and prospects for eternity. Well, we need to define other gods. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Well, you could define another god in the strict sense of any other deity, any other assumed, presumed, divine being. You must never think of it. But then you can go further. What is a god? Why did people have idols and images? Well, for comfort and for solace and to explain their purpose and their fortunes in life. And you may not have recourse to anything to find your supreme happiness and your supreme satisfaction and your supreme fulfillment. Of course, you must love your husband and love your wife and your children. Of course, you must desire things to equip and procure a proper home and proper security and so on. Of course, you must do those things, but they must never be your ultimate delight and your ultimate satisfaction, so that you have to say, if I lost that, that's the end of my life. I couldn't do without that. Christians should never be in a position of thinking or speaking like that with the things of this world. You can enjoy things and appreciate things and delight in things up to a point, but nothing must challenge God as your supreme source of happiness and satisfaction and security and contentment, and the one whom you serve and for whom you strive. Otherwise it becomes a god, becomes an idol. We can make an idol of our families. Some people do that. I hope not Christian people, but you can do it. You can certainly make an idol of your business or your career, and it becomes everything. And you can even love a husband and a wife in a wrong sense, in such a self-gratifying, all-consuming sense that you simply could not under any circumstances live if that particular idol on earth were taken away. Well, then we've gone wrong. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. It's a wonderful commandment, really, because it is designed to keep us close to him. It is designed not only to ban idolatry, but it's designed in order to warn us that it is so easy to drift away from reliance upon the living God, who is the one we must cherish most of all. And it constantly shepherds us, this commandment, into putting God first and making him our chief priority and depending upon him most of all and aspiring for his glory above everything else. And that's where our greatest happiness and fulfillment will be. It keeps us from crippling worries. As soon as we think nothing can help us but something on earth, then we slipped away from trusting and proving the living God. So it is for our positive help, thou shalt have no other gods before me of any kind. I'm trying to argue at the present time, and you may have heard me do so, that evolution is idolatry, because it is treated as a divine being. It's the ultimate pantheism. Evolution has the power to bring about everything that exists. It is as a god, you see. Evolution has the power to bring things about and to explain all that we see. And it's an example of a god. But I don't want to go too far into that. You have to ask the question, have I eclipsed Christ? To have him is the greatest thing, to trust him, to prove him, to have his joy, to do his bidding. And this commandment says, you hear God saying, put me first. Never lose sight of me. Focus on my eternal purpose for you. thou shalt have no other gods before me. It's all about true relationship. Look at verse 4. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. No image, no likeness. Now again, this is not just about the images of the idolater. It is also about any kind of depiction of the true God. This commandment forbids making of any likeness or image, both of true and false gods. All are the same. There is to be no likeness. Now, we can understand that quite simply, but I'm not going to do it at the moment, by looking again at the explanation of the law given by Moses. And it's quite plain that any image of the true God is equally an abomination and included in the commandment. Why would that be? Why, the Roman Catholics now, as in the past, have always said, images, statues, idols, various things that you can see, they help the simple to understand. It is most unreasonable for these Protestants to say that they're unlawful and they're against the second commandment. But they are against the second commandment. Obviously, if you make a likeness or an image of God, which is an earthly creature, or an image of obviously a mythical god, an idol, then that's wrong. But the reason why it's wrong if you even try and make a depiction or a likeness of the true God is you've diminished him. He's impossible to portray. He's far too big for the cleverest artist that ever lived to depict. You can't possibly portray the living God. We are called in the Bible to use our minds, and God emancipates our minds so that we can do so. And he enables us to grasp his attributes and his works. And this is the God we worship. We understand his greatness, his glory, his majesty, that he is a being, an infinite and eternal being, far beyond the limits of any human representation or depiction. And as soon as you try to depict him, you shrivel him up, you insult him, you make him small. So there's no idols in Christianity, no images, no likenesses, nor were there in the Old Testament. Symbols of his work and his acts and his deeds in the Old Testament, but never of God. In fact, even the name of God could not be pronounced directly. So sacred and reverent was it. And this is the second commandment. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God, says the Apostle Paul. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. You cannot draw him, you cannot sculpt or shape him, and if you try, it's a lie what you've done. You cannot depict the flawless, perfect glory of God. It's amazing to me. I know I went there many, many years ago. I think it was over 50 years ago. But in All Souls, Langham Place, up there by Broadcasting House, is a great portrait in oils of Christ at the end of the chancel. And that is supposed to be a Reformed Evangelical Anglican congregation with what we would all say was a breach of the Second Commandment in display upon the wall. And how foolish! Because what is printed on the minds of the worshippers is not the infinite and glorious or the risen Christ. the glorified Christ, of whom three disciples possibly had just a partial glimpse when he was transfigured before them. But we cannot even imagine him, the all-powerful, glorified, risen Lord. But no, they have printed on their minds a totally inadequate artist's impression, needless to say, of an Arian Christ. Dear friends, that's outrage, that kind of thing. Someone was telling me that in the American preacher R.C. Sproul's church, there's something pretty similar at the end of the chancel. And that brother is the one who preaches reform. He's got this dreadful picture at the end of a chancel in his Presbyterian church. Oh, dear friends, the free church tradition always was keep it simple. No depiction of anything, not even a cross. You go into a chapel and you see emblazoned in the wall even a cross, you know that's a more modern building. It's not in accordance with the old nonconformist, Baptist, Congregationalist, Methodist worship traditions of this land. That's an aside, but that's a more modern horror. No, keep it absolutely simple and honor that important commandment. And it elevates the mind. Here we are in a world where images and superstitions dominate so many people, but this commandment sets your mind free to worship God in spirit and in truth, to worship him by his attributes and his deeds and his own revealed descriptions of himself. And you learn to think like that and to view him in that way and to worship him in that elevated way, not in some cramped, superstitious manner where the mind is focused on visuals and images. Look down to verse 7. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. And I want to try and show the riches, just a glimpse of the riches of this commandment, this third commandment. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. The Hebrew translated there, thou shalt not take, literally means thou shalt not lift up. And it would be better if it were translated that way, as in fact William Tyndale translated it, because it helps us to get the sense better. Thou shalt not lift up the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Now, of course, that would apply, yes, to somebody swearing, blasphemously using the name of God. They'd be lifting up the name of God in vain, in some empty oath, something of that sort. But that's not the primary sense. The primary sense is about sincerity. Thou shalt not lift up, as I do at the beginning of a service, when we come to God in prayer and we lift up the name of God. You must not do it, says God to the preacher, nor you as the listener, but the preacher must not lift up the name of the Lord in an empty, futile manner. I am under condemnation of God if I am saying these words mechanically, leading the congregation in prayer, and my heart is not in it. I'm simply going through the words, perhaps so more anxious that the words will be delivered correctly than that the prayer shall be meant. The preacher is under condemnation if he leads the people in prayer without praying himself and doing it sincerely. Look at the commandment, verse 7. Thou shalt not lift up the name of the Lord thy God in vain, in an empty manner. This is a commandment to keep alive our sincerity and our intelligent worship. It's not just about swearing. Thou shalt not read the scripture, we might say, and lift up the name of the Lord without doing it most conscientiously and carefully. Or even he who leads the service is under condemnation. In vain, what an interesting word. It comes from the Hebrew for tempest. Do you see how it works? How the words developed? There's a tempest, and it sweeps across the landscape, and it rips out all the bushes and trees, and it leaves just a barren, empty, desolate wasteland. You must never name the name of the Lord in a desolate, vain, empty way. Feel what you're saying and what you're doing. Do it sincerely. Mean it. If you're leading others in prayer, especially, be careful. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Oh, it might sound negative, but the commandment is designed to keep us sincere before the Lord and to keep us in communion with him, from which all our happiness and assurance flows. The Lord's name, it must register meaning. The Lord's name, he is the self-existent one. That's what the name of the Lord means. Jehovah, I am the self-existent God and the ever-existent God who has supreme power, who has no need of anything to fuel him, to replenish him. We see his attributes. He's our Father, our life-giver, our provider, our authority. And we acknowledge him and affirm his greatness and submit to him. Have some sense of some of those things in your mind whenever you lift up the name of the Lord. And then you engage with him. Then you're in touch with him. This simple commandment in verse 7 is almost a manual of walking with the Lord and staying close to him. It keeps us by him. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Lift it up in a desolate, mechanical, empty way. That's why those people who sing these endlessly repetitive choruses had better be careful. Singing along, enjoying the rhythm and the tune and the instruments and all the crashing and banging and the same words over and over and over again, instead of worshipping God in depth, with an emancipated mind. God isn't turning us into little children. He's giving us depth and thinking minds so that we can have real understanding and joy. And this commandment says all that, this: thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. I would like to deal with the Sabbath day, but there's very little time. Just to read it, and then at least we've looked at four commandments. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath day. All manner of things we could say about that. Remember it, because it had never actually been forgotten. The creation ordinance wasn't started with the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. Remember the Sabbath day, that ancient institution. Remember it, to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labour and do all thy work, but the seventh, now the first day of the week, of course, was surely under the inspiration of God. The apostles changed the day of worship to the first day of the week, that is the Christian Sabbath, the day of resurrection. In it thou shalt not do any work. In other words, not unless we are following some profession, a healing profession or an essential work, just to please ourselves, earn our living. Unless we're forced to do, we must have a day of worship for the Lord. If we can't do it on traditional Sunday, then we do it on some other day. This commandment, this fourth commandment, is a, well, everyone will be judged by it. Even people who don't understand it, who've never heard of it. There may be people up and down this land on the Lord's Day who wash their cars on Sunday morning, do just about everything but worship, are not the slightest bit interested, and they will be judged not only by the other nine commandments, but by this commandment, breaking the Sabbath principle. Is that fair? If they've never read it? If they don't understand it? Yes, because the form in which they will be judged is according to the principle of the commandment. It was obvious to us all that we are created beings, that there is a God. And we have said in our hearts, we won't believe in him, we reject him, we will not honour him, we do not owe him anything, we will not be grateful, we will not pay homage, we will not, we'll pass that church at the end of the road and another one round the corner, and not for a moment will we ever consider that perhaps we have any obligation, any debt, any thanksgiving due, any homage to pay to a Creator God. In some shape or form, the principle of time for God will be, people will be judged by their rejection of that principle, even if they've never heard this commandment read out, because it's written into human constitution that we are created beings and there should be some seeking and honouring of the living God. So we are all indebted to the saving work of Christ for delivering us from the punishment that we deserved. But for Christian people, we're under this law. And as far as we're able, we give time to this Lord's Day. And I've written about that, and our time is up, so I'm not going to say any more about it now. But the first commandment we considered keeps alive a true relationship with God. The second one elevates our minds so that we're thinking and liberated people, not superstitious image worshippers. The third commandment promotes sincerity. We dare not utter the name of the Lord in vain, in worship at any time. And the Lord's Day, the Sabbath principle, orders and regulates life. The Jews of old, agrarian people, they had so much organization to do to make the Sabbath work. Everything on the farm had to be organized for a day when nothing could be done. And so it is with us. We organize our lives so that we can honor worship, the service of God, the testimony of Christ, making him known, and studying the things of God on the Lord's Day. And we get stamped into our lives priorities that affects the rest of our life. And every day of the week, our priority for devotions, for honouring Christ, for being his representative. And it all really focuses onto this Sabbath commandment. And so you see some of the riches of God's law, even in those first four commandments, and the immense benefit that they are to God's people. Let's close our thinking tonight, singing the hymn.